all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW-2 helicopter pilot type, United States Army, 1967 to 1971. 100 years ago, almost, seems like. Of course, my math is getting worse as I get older, it seems. Well, welcome to Veterans Radio, and we're very excited and honored to have you on our program today. We've got a great one lined up. We've got two guests coming up to you. We've got a pre-recorded interview that my partner, Mr. Falzone, Jim Falzone, did with Colonel Stephen Potter. And Stephen Potter is assigned to a program over in Liberia. I bet you didn't know we had a Michigan National Guard had a unit deployed to Liberia. Yeah, it's called Operation Upward Liberty. And so that's going to be on in during the second half of the program. And on the first half of the program, we're going to have a gentleman. His name is Tom Glenn, and Tom is an Army veteran. He is a writer. He is a clandestine spy for different organizations. Spent more time in Vietnam probably than any of us that I know combined. And so he's going to be on it right after the first break. So I'm excited to have Tom on the program. And also, can't wait for you to hear this story about what's going on in Liberia. It's very interesting to know that we have troops over there, and it has nothing to do with Ebola. So other couple of things I wanted to talk about. Number one is that we got a great response to last week's program, and that was about the Agent Orange town hall that was held up in Northville, Michigan. And I got a lot of emails from people asking for more information. And so I want to make sure that you can get this information. If you want to, you can go to the website for the local Vietnam Veterans of America. It's VVA528.org. That's VVA528.org. And you click on their website, and they have all kinds of information that about Agent Orange, not only older information, but also the new information that was presented at their town hall. And so I want to thank everybody who has asked us for more information. This is really important, folks, because what we're talking about with this Agent Orange town hall is the legacy of the effects of dioxin, of the herbicide dioxin. Agent Orange is kind of a generic term for what they sprayed to kill the defoliation. In fact, I just got an email earlier this afternoon, and which is what reminded me of this, a gentleman who was stationed stateside and is suffering many, many symptoms associated with the herbicide dioxin. And so if he goes to this website, the VVA 528, he will find a list of all of the military bases that used this dioxin to kill the vegetation around their perimeters as well. So don't let anybody tell you that you may not have been exposed to this stuff. In fact, most everybody that has served at some point in the military, especially during the Vietnam era and the Korean era and around many of the military bases, chances are pretty good that you might have been exposed to this stuff. So go to the VA, make sure you get your Agent Orange physical and register to get that physical, because they run blood tests and all kinds of things. And you don't know. Who knows what you've been exposed to and how it's going to affect your particular body. But what we were talking about last week was the idea of this legacy is that the effects of this herbicide dioxin can go down through the generations. So go check out this website and find out what's going on. Maybe it can help you. Maybe it can't. You know. The other thing is I want to thank our listener, Mike from Ecuador, for sending us an email this week making us aware of how much he enjoyed the program. He is an expatriate living down there, and he was talking about going into our archives, and he pointed out that one of our archives was mislabeled, and so that we needed to correct that. Well, Mike, I think it's been corrected. I know that we're working on it. So thanks for the email. We greatly appreciate that. By the way, any of you out there who would like to have a story that you think might go well on Veterans Radio, go to our website, veteransradio.net, click on Contact Us, and write down your brief description of why you should be on Veterans Radio, and we'll consider it, because that's where I got this information for our shows today. So make sure that you do that. Let's see, what else is there? Oh, yes, Veterans Radio has a fundraiser going. We're trying to raise some funds. We want to stay on commercial radio as long as we possibly can, and we're also in the process of building an internet radio station. In fact, you can go to, I think it's called Live365/Veterans Radio Network, and we're starting to put some programs up there. And so we've got an Indiegogo. How's that one? I need you in here to feed off of you. Anyway, we've got an Indiegogo fundraiser going, and you can go to our website. Again, that's veteransradio.net. Click on the little logo that we've put up there that says Support Veterans Radio. That's an order. That's the place where you can go and help us out. And we've got a couple of books that we've gotten giveaways, and I've gotten some emails from other authors who are going to be donating their books if you make a contribution to keep Veterans Radio growing. So we want to thank you all who have contributed so far. It was really kind of cool to see that actually some money has shown up in the accounts. Not in our accounts yet. It won't happen until the end of June. But if you want to help out and you like what we're doing here on Veterans Radio, please go there and help our fundraiser, and we'll be able to keep these stories going for another 13 years if we can do that. So we're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back with our first guest, is Tom Glenn. So stay tuned. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
May is Military Appreciation Month, and this May, Conway Truckload is introducing True to the Troops, a new initiative to help military veterans find exciting career opportunities as professional drivers. Conway Truckload honors veterans and respects the values they stand for. After all, teamwork and dedication are values that have made Conway Truckload a leader in the transportation industry. For more information about driving opportunities at Conway Truckload, visit TrueToTheTroops.com or call 866-WORK-FOR-US.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. Make sure that you go to the Conway Truckload to find out about all the different opportunities and opportunities that they have for you as a veteran if you're looking for jobs. And also for any of the civilians out there, the trucking industry is looking for drivers. So get on out there and maybe they can help you out too. Joining me on Veterans Radio right now is a new guest to our program. His name is Tom Glenn. He has worked as an intelligence operative. He is a musician. He's a linguist. He speaks 7 languages. I heard, as you can tell, I have difficulty with 1. But he speaks 7 languages. He's a cryptologist, a government executive, a caregiver, leadership coach, and has always been a writer. And so he was in Saigon when it fell, and I think that's going to be a lot of our part of our discussion today. So I want to welcome Tom Glenn to Veterans Radio. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much, Dale.
It's a real pleasure to talk with you, Tom. After I had talked with you earlier in the week and I started going into the other information that I found out about you, you are quite the prolific writer.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And the stories are they're pretty gut-wrenching, the ones that, that I've read so far, but you certainly get the emotion down about how not only people in the military feel, but also our extended families.
Well, when you've been through the stuff I've been through, my tendency is to write rather dark stories, but they almost always end hopefully. So there's some light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, that's good. That's good. Let's go back and talk about Tom Glenn back in the early 60s when you were in the service. How did you get involved in the military, and then we'll start going forward with that.
Okay. I'm a natural-born linguist. As a child, I taught myself French and Italian. I studied Latin for 4 years in high school, then in college I took German. And when I graduated, I wanted to study Chinese, a language that had always fascinated me.
Wow.
I knew that it was too complex, I couldn't learn it by myself, so I joined the Army to go to the Army language school. But when I got there, instead of giving me Chinese, they gave me Vietnamese for a full year intensive course, 6 hours a day in the classroom, 2 hours a night, study 5 days a week for a year. And when I graduated, I wanted them to send me to Vietnam, but they didn't. It turned out that if you graduate first in your class, you always go to the National Security Agency right outside of Washington, D.C., so that's where I ended up. Then, since I was close to Georgetown University, I enrolled there to take a master's in Chinese. So by the time I was a civilian again, and this was in 1962, I was already comfortable in French, Chinese, and Vietnamese, all 3 languages spoken in Vietnam. And so, of course, they immediately sent me to Vietnam.
Oh, so then they finally got it right. All right. So now you're in Vietnam, but you're not there with the military.
No. I was operating clandestinely, but I was working with military units, both Army and Marine Corps. And when I was with them, I always dressed like a troop, cut my hair like theirs. I looked very young, and the purpose of doing all that was to be sure that the enemy didn't know that they had a spy in their midst.
Oh. So you probably can't tell us too much about this, otherwise you have to kill us, right?
Not anymore. It's all been declassified. Well, almost all of it has been declassified.
I know. I signed one of those things myself.
So, I understand.
So let's go back just a little bit. So you were working with which troops? With ours or with the Vietnamese troops?
Well, for up until 1973, it was with American troops all over the country, with Marine units and Army units, primarily tactical intelligence support. I was telling them where the enemy was, what the enemy was going to do, warning them when an attack was coming,
okay,
targeting, that kind of thing.
Okay, so you're the guy that told our company when I was up in a place called Quan Loi that at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we were going to get hit with a ground attack. And
yep,
sure enough, at 3 o'clock, all these bad guys stood up about, I don't know, 500 yards away and started running toward our fence.
Yep, that would have been me. You
okay.
Got it.
Thanks a lot.
Well, at least
well,
I warned everyone.
You know, at least we were prepared for it.
Well, the bad thing about it, Dale, was that there were times when I was not believed.
Oh, sure.
And the attacks came, and the commanders were very surprised. Then they believed me after that, but commanders change so often in Vietnam that, you know, I would warn one guy, he would believe me after that, but then a week later he was replaced and I had to start all over again.
Well, that was one of the things that I thought was rather interesting, and I just read an article in the, I think it was the Vietnam Veterans of America magazine that was talking about an RLO, a real live officer. And, because I was a warrant officer and we didn't have any of that command responsibility, and I noticed that in the company that I was in, aviation company, we changed commanders every 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think they did that in pretty much all of the units over there.
Well, I don't know what the cycle length was. All I know is that it was very common for me to finally get to be working with a commander who would believe my warnings, and then he would leave and I'd have to start all over again by proving what I had to say was true.
Well, it was very frustrating. I can only imagine what it must have been like for you. I know it was frustrating sometimes for us because I landed in the middle of one of them, and then there was a switchover, and then there was another. So I had three commanders during the year I was in Vietnam.
Sure.
And each one, you know, was a little different than the other.
Well, there's a rather famous story that goes with all that. In 1967, I was in the Highlands near Pleiku, and I foresaw, through intercepted North Vietnamese communications, that an attack was coming. I warned the commander of the 4th Infantry Division, who's one of the units I was supporting. He didn't believe me. When the attack came, it was a big one, and it was one of the major battles of the war. It was called the Doc Tho Offensive.
Right. Oh, yes. Okay.
And a whole battalion was virtually destroyed as a result of that, of the fact that he was not prepared for it. And it ended up being a huge battle. I don't remember the losses anymore, but it was hundreds on the American side and about 1,500 to 2,000 on the North Vietnamese side. After that, he believed me, but the week later, he left and a new guy came in. I had to start explaining to him who I was, why I knew what was going to happen.
We had, I'm trying to remember, there was a guy I had gone to college with that I met up with in Vietnam, which is really one of these weird situations, you know, don't I know you? Yeah, I know you, this type of thing.
Yeah.
And on that particular day, we picked up two suspected NVA soldiers or Viet Cong. I can't remember the whole story. But I remember that they had them blindfolded, and I'm probably breaking protocol here, but this is a true story, folks, I promise. And he said, I want you to pretend that you're taking off. Pretend. He says, yeah, just bring it up to a hover, you know, make a lot of noise like we're flying and so forth, but don't get too high. And so I said, okay. So I took it up to a hover and, you know, started moving back and forth and so forth. And he started asking questions of these two prisoners. And they still had blindfolds on, so he didn't know. And when they wouldn't say anything, he says, I told him I'm going to throw you out of the helicopter. And, you know, oh, sure, right. You know, and of course, we're all going, whoa, what's going on here? And he did. He threw one out. We were only 3 feet off the ground.
Lord.
3 feet off the ground. And the other guy, of course, started telling everything that, you know, anybody ever wanted to know about what was happening. He says, sometimes you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't the waterboarding. It wasn't physically abusing these guys. It was just pure psychological I guess, warfare, for lack of a better term. But did you, were you involved in the run up to Tet then?
Oh yes.
Tell our audience.
Another famous story. I
got to remind you. Hold on. I got to remind our eyes. We're talking with Tom Glenn, who was in the military, and then he was out of the military as a undercover NSA employee working in Vietnam. And his job was to collect information about what the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong were doing. And so he's got some pretty good insight here. So we're coming up to the Tet Offensive, which people thought they knew was coming, but they didn't know when or how big it was going to be, did they?
Well, I knew.
Well, I know, but nobody listened to you.
Well, that was the problem. That's another one of my stories. I personally briefed General Westmoreland, told him it was coming. I told him when it was coming. I told him it was going to be a countrywide offensive, and he didn't believe me. So the American troops were simply not prepared for it. We have to bear in mind that the Tet Offensive was a major catastrophe for the North Vietnamese. They lost thousands and thousands of troops, and they were defeated on every battlefield. But it had a psychological impact in the United States, which was one of the reasons they did what they did.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, we had plenty of warning from signals intelligence, and we weren't believed.
You had, I'm trying to find something in my notes that you had written down about the idea of finding out this information and that Westmoreland had not paid attention to you, and that also, you know, they sent the South Vietnamese Army on break for, you know, the New
Year.
Yeah,
well, it was Vietnamese New Year's. Everybody was celebrating.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, here's a line, and I found it. You can find a lot of stuff, I should tell our audience, you know, about Tom Glenn. It's Tom, TomGlenn, and he's got a couple of different websites here, and this one was the one I was reading last night was about the Vietnam tragedy. And you've got a quote in here from Ho Chi Minh, and I'm sure that many of us who are in Vietnam know that says, you know, you can kill 10 of my men for every one I kill of yours, but even at those odds, you will lose and I will win.
Yes, and he was right.
And that was the mentality of what we were fighting over there.
Absolutely. Well, the thing we never took into account, or at least Westmoreland didn't, was that the North Vietnamese were determined to win that war if it cost every person that lived in Vietnam. They were willing to sacrifice everybody. They were absolutely determined. We were not. We were there as a foreign force. We were not going to sacrifice everything and everybody in the United States to win that war. So their determination essentially outdid ours. And that's what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly makes sense. And we know that there were opportunities prior, even, you know, right after World War II, where we could have been the ones that were helping Ho Chi Minh instead of deciding.
Absolutely.
You know, that we were.
Yeah, that was the big mistake we made. He came to us and asked for help to get rid of the French colonials who were occupying his country, and we turned him down and sided with the French. So then he went to the Russians and the Chinese and got the help he needed.
Before our phones light up like crazy here, you know, Ho Chi Minh was a communist, correct?
He was, yeah.
Okay.
But in the beginning, he was mostly a nationalist. He wanted freedom for Vietnam. And he went more and more to the communist side as the Westerners refused to help him.
Well, that's kind of a bad mistake, that's for darn sure. So
yeah.
Were you in Vietnam continuously from, you know, up until 75?
No, I first arrived in 1962. I was there on and off for the next 13 years, but I wasn't there throughout the whole time. Every year between 62 and 75 was in country at least 4 months. I had 2 complete tours there, both of them with my family, by the way.
Oh, really?
My wife and my 4 children at the end in Saigon, yeah.
Holy mackerel. So you were in Saigon with your family when everybody was trying to get out?
You bet.
Okay, so we got about 7 or 8 minutes here. Let's go to that point.
Okay.
So now, you know, we've left, you know, the active military has left pretty much, and you're still there, and now you got to get out.
Yeah.
What happened?
What happened was that, once again, I knew from intercepted North Vietnamese communications that the city was going to be attacked. I warned the ambassador, Graham Martin, and he didn't believe me. He said instead it was communications deception on the part of the North Vietnamese. He wouldn't allow me to evacuate my people. I had 43 guys working for me, their wives and their children, living in Saigon. So I lied and I cheated and I stole to get my people out of the country. Sent them out on any ruse I could think of. Sent them out on phony home leave or fake vacations or trumped up business travel, anything I could think of. And toward the end, I took money out of my own pocket. I bought a ticket on Pan Am, put one of my guys on the plane with no orders, no authorization, and told him to go. And that turned out to be the last Pan Am flight out of Saigon. I finally got down to just three of us. The ambassador did not catch on. He didn't realize what I was doing. It was me and two communicators who had agreed to stay with me to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there when the attack took place.
Well, you weren't. I mean, we had we just did a program on this with the documentary that Rory Kennedy put out.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, evidently the ambassador was so idealistic that he just thought for some reason there was going to be this interaction of somebody's going to come along and save everybody. And I know the people there with the military were also trying to get people out at the same time and coming up with any excuse that they could use to get these folks out.
My own reading of what was going on with the ambassador was that we didn't have a name for it back then, but now it's called, sociologists have come up with I can't think of the name of it, but what happens is a group of people ignore the evidence because they are so firmly in belief because of an ideology that they reject all the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was going on there. He never did call for an evacuation. He was finally countermanded, I think, by the president. But that was after the North Vietnamese were already in the streets of the city, and it was too late to get an awful lot of people out after that.
So how did you get out?
On the night of the 29th of April, I had finally gotten my two communicators out that afternoon, and the guy who came in just that morning for the evacuation after it was finally declared was Al Gray. He was at that time a Marine colonel. He and I had worked for years in Vietnam, ever since he was a captain and I was a GS-13. I got him to get my two guys out. And then after it was getting dark, it was raining, he finally got me on a chopper. When we took off, I saw the tracers coming at us. We were hit by so much lead, I thought we were going down, but we made it. And we flew out to the 7th Fleet that was cruising on the South China Sea. And my guys were saved, and I was safe.
That's got to be scary. That's the only thing I can think about, you know, is that flying at night was bad enough, but when people are starting to shoot at you and you can see the tracers coming up at you, they seem to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
God, yes.
And,
you probably experienced that yourself. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, they start looking like basketballs. And how the heck did they miss me here?
And you'll appreciate this. When we got out to the 7th Fleet, it was dark. It was raining. The guy went down very slowly and landed on the floodlit helipad of the Oklahoma City, the command ship of the fleet. And when we got out of the helicopter, he told me that he, a civilian pilot, had never before landed on a ship. That made me feel really good.
It's amazing. As you say, it's amazing what you have to do in order to survive.
Yeah.
Tom, I know you've done a number of I found really fascinating writing. I can't wait to read them all. Where would people go to find your information?
Where to find the information?
Right, yeah. If they want
any
to
of my
read,
websites, TomTellsTales.org, VietnamTragedy.org, NoAccounts.org. I've left one out. And I've got a new book coming out, so I'll have a fifth site, and that's going to be called The Tryon Syndrome, about a Vietnam vet suffering from post-traumatic stress injury, which I suffer from. That's why I wrote the book.
It's interesting, as I was reading through much of the things that you've written, that a lot of these are helpful. I mean, it's really cathartic to write these stories down and the things that are, you know, in your mind just to get this stuff out.
Yes, that's why I did it.
You know, because you talk to veterans. I mean, we talk to them all the time, and people our ages, they were fine up until, you know, 30 years after they left Vietnam.
Mm.
And then they started thinking about it, or their behavior started getting a little bit unusual and so forth, and they finally, you know, starting to get the help that they need. So I encourage people to go and find some of these stories that Tom has written. I think that you're going to really like them. I got to let you go here in a second, Tom. But I wanted to read something that I found from you, and that was from Gerald May. That was General May.
Oh yes.
All right, I'm gonna close with that one. And this is a Memorial Day. Since Memorial Day is coming up in the next couple of weeks, we want to make sure that people are aware of these things. And he's talking about he didn't give the speech, but it was supposed to be given on Washington Mall, right? And so Charles Durning did it. So he says, "All of us who have lost loved ones know the searing pain of grief. We know how difficult, even impossible, it is to let go. Grief is our wound, the hole inside us left by each precious life that has been taken from us, an emptiness that indeed can never be filled by anyone else. We go on with our lives, we must. But on Memorial Day, as we remember those who have died for our country, let us be reminded that grief is a sacred wound. Let us respect our own grieving, for it is, after all, an expression of our love. And it is an honoring for those who died for us. Let us be assured that the feeling we call grief, the shock, the sadness, its anger and confusion, and most of all, its loneliness, is our way of saying we love you." I want to thank you, Tom Glenn, for being on Veterans Radio, and I can't wait to have you back on to talk more about your books. We didn't get a chance to talk about Friendly Casualties and the other ones, but I think it's a great introduction to our audience. So I encourage our people to go and look up Tom Glenn, G-L-E-N-N. I think that you're going to learn a lot about...
Yeah, you can find me on the web pretty easily.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom.
Hey, Dale, thank you so much.
All right, we'll be talking to you again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, real quickly, I got to set up what's going to be on in the second half of the program, and that's going to be a pre-recorded interview that Jim Falzone did with a Colonel Stephen Potter, who was with that organization I talked about, the Operation Onward Liberty, about what's going on in Liberia. So tune in for that at the end of the news, and maybe I'll get a second to talk to you then. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're going to play a pre-recorded interview that my partner, Jim Falzone, did with a Colonel Stephen Potter. And Stephen is from Michigan, and he's with the Michigan National Guard, and he has just recently been sent over to Liberia to be part of the Operation Onward Liberty program that is going on over there. And he's going to be talking a little bit about his background of being in the military itself and also in being in the Michigan National Guard. So we're going to play that, and I should have about a minute at the end to kind of wrap up the whole program. So here's Jim Falzone with Colonel Stephen Potter.
Okay, that's fine. I would say as a kid, I always showed an interest in the military from the time I was young. And I come from a family who has a lot of military ties. So my grandpa was a fighter pilot in World War II. He was killed in action, and my father's adopted grandpa was an officer in the Michigan Army National Guard, actually served in the 119th Field Artillery. So I had role models at a young age who were in the military. But I would say that the kicker was the fact that when I was in college, when I was in high school, my sister started to date an officer cadet at Michigan State, and he became a role model to me and encouraged me to pursue a commission in the military, as well as a career in the Airborne Ranger field when I was in high school. So I chose to do that and commissioned through Michigan State and went through all the schooling, the Airborne Ranger school and air assault and all those, and eventually made my way to the Ranger Regiment and served there on active duty. So that was really the genesis of my interest in serving.
Well, we think it's always important to let our listening audience sort of know where the men and women sort of got that spark that encourage them along the way to serve their country by getting involved in military service. And you used the ROTC program at Michigan State, I believe, to go through college. Is that correct?
That's correct. I joined the ROTC right at the very beginning of September of my freshman year, and I competed for a scholarship which provided room and board and tuition for the final 3 years of college, which was, I can say, one of my father's happier moments during that period of my life when I called him and told him that he didn't have to worry about my college tuition any longer. He was pretty happy.
Yeah, I think that's a natural dad reaction there. And I often hear from kids, well, I can't afford to go to college, and I point them to ROTC or joining up so that they can use the GI Bill. There are ways to do this if you're so motivated, aren't there?
I'm sorry, I missed you for a second there.
Yeah, not a problem. And one of the challenges we'll have throughout the broadcast is for our listening audience is there is a couple of second delay between us here in the Michigan area and Colonel Potter in Liberia. So we apologize for any of that, but that's just a natural condition. So, Steve, let me move you on. After you got out of college, walk us through your first few assignments.
So I was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Nuclear Biological Chemical Warfare Service, and went to my officer basic school at Fort McClellan, Alabama. And once I was finished with that, I went through Ranger School and was assigned to 2nd Infantry Division in Korea, Camp Hovey, Korea, where I was a battalion nuclear biological chemical warfare officer working in the operations shop and 1-5 Infantry in Korea. And then while I was there, I competed and earned a slot into the 1st Ranger Battalion, which is in Savannah, Georgia, and had a chance to serve there as a chemical warfare officer as well on the staff advising the battalion commander on all of those matters. Upon completion of that, I went to officer advanced course again at Fort McClellan. And at that point I was assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division, for a short period on the staff and then as a company commander of a chemical warfare company.
And back at that period of time, what were you thinking about and what were you doing as it related to chemical warfare, which over time became a little more intense, I believe?
Initially in Korea, it was always a clear and present danger to us every day because there was verified intelligence that the North Koreans had chemical warheads, and we were prepared for that, and to the point where everyone had their chemical warfare gear close to them, and we would do drills quite frequently on putting on the mask and putting on the chemical warfare suit and just preparing to defend South Korea in a chemical warfare area. When I got to the Ranger Battalion in 1996, there was an attack on the subway system in Korea, in Tokyo, by a terrorist organization called the Aumshin Rico Cult, and they used sarin gas on the subway system, which really changed quite a bit in regards to the Rangers and the special operations and our preparation. So we immediately began preparing for potential scenarios where the U.S. government would use special operations to offensively deal with an organization in the world who had a chemical warfare or biological warfare capability that needed to be verified and possibly taken out.
And as you proceeded with the your time in the Rangers, kind of walk us through that progression.
I spent around 2 years in the Ranger Battalion. I got there in 1994 in the fall. Within a month of arriving at the Ranger Battalion, we were deployed to Haiti as part of the invasion force to restore the rightful ruler of Haiti. And we were part of a direct action team that was prepared to execute that operation. It was called Uphold Democracy. We were deployed there on an aircraft carrier in a special operations configuration with helicopters and things. The political leaders from the United States were successful in negotiating with the ruler who had taken over Haiti. His name was Raul Segres, and he was a police commander. And they successfully negotiated him to step down, and we ended up not having to invade the country, rather sent a peacekeeping force in, which didn't include the Rangers. And then the rest of the tour from 1994 to 1996 was all spent doing regular training rotations. We did spend some time in Central and South America doing jungle warfare training, as well as various bilateral training arrangements in Central America, which was an area in the 80s and 90s, which we were very concerned about. So we did quite a bit of training down there.
Well, and you've had a number of overseas assignments. That includes some time in Afghanistan for Operation Enduring Freedom, doesn't it?
It does. I was actually I was deployed to Afghanistan as part of the 46th Military Police Command from 2010 to 2011, and our mission was to operate the detention facility, the main detention facility in Parwan for the country, and we also established, trained, and equipped Afghan Corrections Brigade, which was around 3,000 Afghan soldiers that we recruited, vetted, trained, and employed. And eventually, they assumed mission control of that U.S. prison, was turned over to Afghanistan, I believe, in 2013. So that was our tour in Afghanistan. We were stationed at Bagram Airfield.
Now, Colonel, and I think I skipped over this in the timeline, but somewhere you went from active duty to the Michigan Army National Guard. Maybe talk about that transition a little bit.
Yes. So in 1999, I had finished my company command tour in the 82nd and was looking at goals, future goals, and what I wanted to achieve in my career from a civilian standpoint, and felt it was a good break point to move from active duty. There was a large recruiting push at that point. The economy was very strong, and there were a lot of civilian companies that were recruiting mid-career U.S. Army captains and hiring them into their corporation. So I actually got to personally interview with Ross Perot, and that was my first job working for him in Perot Systems, which was his IT company that he started. And as part of that transition, I didn't have any break in service, just transitioned my commission from active duty to the National Guard and started serving in the 177 Military Police Brigade in Taylor, Michigan, was my first assignment. And that was 1999.
Well, for somebody who graduated from Waverly High School, you had a pretty interesting run all over the world, didn't you?
It's been exciting. I have to say that at this point I've served on every continent except for Antarctica, which, you know, at some point I might be able to at least do some sort of military training down there possibly. But, you know, serving in Latvia and Europe with the National Guard, here in Africa with the National Guard, Asia as part of active duty and the deployments and training in South and Central America, it's been very fulfilling as a career, and I'm looking forward to continuing to serve after this tour as well.
And you must have a pretty understanding family at home.
Well, I would say they're very supportive. They're very patriotic. They understand that as part of their dad and their you know, my wife or her husband's service to the Army in the country, it often calls for me to go away and serve for periods of time. So they realize it. They understand I love what I do and I'm passionate about being a soldier, and we view it as a team effort. So and frankly, sometimes it strengthens our family, because when I get home, all of us appreciate each other a little more. So it's not always a bad deal.
Well, we all, again, try to remind our listeners that our military men and women can't do what they do for the country without the support of their family, whether it be their spouses and their kids or their parents and their grandparents. It really is a team effort, and I think this is you've highlighted a good example of that, and one that those who are listening should never really forget. It really takes that whole family effort to make this work, and that's particularly true for folks in the Guard and Reserve. You've probably experienced that difference between the active duty bases and how it feels coming from a Guard and Reserve standpoint. Can you kind of give us a little bit of that?
Yeah, I would say that you know, the big difference is that when you're in an active duty base, you every day you're serving with those soldiers and a little closer together. In the Guard, obviously we all have civilian jobs and we all have other priorities that we're focused on. But the commonality is actually when you come together for your training or you come together for a deployment, it's very similar. The families are a little more spread out, but the soldiers come together and they're part of a team, and it's really, by the time the unit forms and is sent to their mission, wherever it may be, they're operating as a cohesive team as much as or better sometimes than an active duty organization. There are challenges you face in the Guard that are different, but the Guard does have a very strong support structure, both with the family support groups and the National Guard headquarters in Lansing, Michigan, has a strong family programs office that provides all sorts of opportunities and resources for soldiers and families who are deployed. So it's not since 9/11, with all the deployments we've done, they've really increased those resources significantly.
And I want to remind the Veterans Radio listeners that we're talking to Colonel Stephen Potter. He is dual branched with specialties in the military, police, and chemical and biological and nuclear defense. And I'm your host, Jim Fossone, broadcasting from the Legal Help for Veterans radio station in Northville, Michigan. Colonel, I know you in your civilian life as well. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your reference? A lot of your troops, particularly the Guard and Reserve troops, bring to it a certain set of civilian skills. Talk a little bit about your civilian skills.
Well, I think actually I have spent the last 10 years growing a business that is very similar in nature and uses a lot of the skills that I have in the National Guard, doing work in emergency management and homeland security for civil agencies as well as the Department of Defense. It's been a nice connection for me because a lot of the skills that I learned in the military from the chemical biological warfare and some of the protection of critical assets and some of the programs we put in place in the military police are all best practices that when they are implemented in civil agencies or in civil situations can make cities, counties, and other organizations that choose to bring us on board much more safe, much more secure, and much better prepared for any sort of incidents or disasters. So it's been a nice connection for me to, and I've chosen to do this, to keep a personal and professional connection between my military career and my civilian career. And a lot of Guardsmen do that. You'll find a lot of National Guardsmen who are in senior level positions are often in senior level positions in corporate America. You often find that military police officers or others in those specialties will have a civilian career in the police field or something like that. So there's often a lot of commonalities between a Guardsman's career, civilian career, and their service in the Guard.
Well, let's turn now to Operation Onward Liberty. We're talking to Colonel Stephen Potter, who is in Liberia at the moment, heading up that role as commander of Operation Onward Liberty. Steve, can you tell us what this program's about and what specifically Operation Onward Liberty is about?
Sure. Onward Liberty is a program that is run through U.S. Army AFA. It is a one-of-a-kind program that provides, at this point, 15 embedded mentors from the rank of sergeant up to my rank of colonel. And we are paired up with our counterparts in the Liberian Armed Forces of Liberia. And this program has been going on since 2010 and will likely go on one more year. The reason the Michigan National Guard is providing the mentors is we are the state partner of Liberia. So oftentimes a National Guard headquarters and state will partner with the country. Our mentors provide all sorts of expertise to the Armed Forces of Liberia, including logistics, training management, operations, leadership development. Sometimes we'll teach courses in leadership development. And oftentimes the mentor will just be a sounding board for the officer or a sergeant that they're working with in the Armed Forces of Liberia. So the AFL, the Armed Forces of Liberia, has only been reconstituted after the last civil war since 2008. So every officer or enlisted, including the commanding general, none of them have over 8 years of service at this point. So they're very inexperienced compared to other militaries, and they rely on our advice quite frequently.
And give us some sense, Colonel, of the size of the Liberian Army, and is it an army in the sense that we know it here in the United States, or is it more akin to some other form?
It's a small army. It is highly modeled after the United States because we have been in here quite a bit with mentorship and training and advisory services. So it would be very similar to, in the United States Army, what a brigade would be, which is around 2,000 to 3,000 soldiers if it was at full strength, which it's currently not. So they have two infantry battalions, a military police company, an engineer company, which has vertical and horizontal construction, as well as demolitions and other specialties. They have a medical command, which has which runs a few clinics and hospitals on the military bases. They have a logistics command that runs all logistics, including maintenance management, supply, and facility management. And they have a training command that operates two bases right now, where they do basic training, non-commissioned officer academies, as well as some other specialty courses. And then the final unit is a Liberian Coast Guard, which is a small, 100 to 200 person fleet. They have a fleet of six vehicles and six ships. Again, highly modeled after the United States Coast Guard. So they've got a couple Zodiacs as well as a couple larger boats to do coastal patrols and fishery enforcement and things like that. So, again, very a lot of the model that they followed is very similar to the U.S. military.
So can you remind us who the neighbors are of Liberia and sort of who they're as they maybe plan for what their future uses of force might have to be? What's going on in the region that this all ties into but that we Americans don't hear a lot about?
Sure. So you've probably seen Liberia in the news recently. It was the hit country from the Ebola virus disease, and three countries were primarily affected, and two of them neighbored Liberia. So you have Guinea, which sort of wraps around Liberia to the east, as well as a little to the north of Liberia's other neighbor, which is Sierra Leone, immediately to the north. Those three countries and Cote d'Ivoire, which is to the south of Liberia, all make up an organization called the Manu River Union, which is a regional collaborative, which they're trying to use to share security cooperation, economic cooperation, and other regional interests. So Liberia is a very close ally of the United States and gets significant investment from our country in the areas of security cooperation, aid, and development efforts, all part of our cooperation with the country.
Is there a similar operation going on in Sierra Leone or Guinea where U.S. military are helping their armed forces become a little more professional, a little more organized?
I'll start with Guinea. Guinea actually has a state partner, I believe it's Ohio, who is who does more traditional security cooperation activities, which would be sending in training teams for short periods, including a few days up to 2 to 3 weeks, normal, which is a more normal security cooperation environment. Sierra Leone, being a former British colony, has a strong British mentorship presence that supports both the British. The British Army has a large contingent in assisting with some security cooperation activities, as well as embedded mentors in the Army and the police force. So Sierra Leone has a very similar program as to what Onward Liberty is for Liberia, but it's provided by the British.
Well, this is very interesting information. Again, it's not something we in the United States get much education on or daily content on in our newspapers, so I really appreciate a little bit of the background, but I have to back up to Ebola and ask you what precautions or concerns exist for our military in a country like Liberia when they're facing that sort of public health crisis?
I'll address the initial group of soldiers. The 101st Airborne Division came in the country here as part of the Ebola support mission, and they took precautions that were appropriate at the time because the Ebola disease had sort of spiked at that point. That was around August, September, October time frame. And they had personal protective equipment as far as masks and suits and gloves and boots that they were prepared to sup anytime they were entering in what was called an Ebola treatment unit, which is something that they were, their mission was to build the Ebola treatment units. When they were built, they would generally leave and move on to the next one, and that was primarily their mission. For our Onward Lead team, we have all the same precautionary gear, and at this point have not had to put it into place because the country here has only had one case of Ebola, one single case in the past 50 days, and the country is really moving forward towards economic recovery. All of the health systems that were put in place to eliminate Ebola are still continuing from the government of Liberia standpoint. And the precautions that were in place as far as continuously washing hands, not touching. There hasn't been a lot of handshaking since we've been here. Most everybody uses something called the elbow bump to greet each other. And that's been very successful to go from a high of around 3,000 cases to, at this point, zero in the country. I mean, to me, that's a great success.
Well, that is. And again, it's something that doesn't catch a lot of press here in the United States, and we're glad to bring to our veteran radio listeners right from the source, from Colonel Steve Potter, who's in Liberia as we speak, as part of Operation Onward Liberty. Let's do a little more general education here, Colonel. Tell us a little bit about the countryside of Liberia and the climate and the folks. Just give us that human element.
Yeah, so Liberia is located very near the equator. I think we're on the 10-degree line. So it's very, the climate here is very, it's very hot, very humid, what you would typically see in a country that was so closely located to the equator. There's not really a, there's two seasons in Liberia. It's the dry season and the rainy season. And the dry season is just ending right now. And the rainy season goes from, late April here until all the way to, October. The southern portion of Liberia has a lot of rainforest areas. The north portion and the northwest portion has some upland areas with even some areas that are starting to get sort of mountainous in those areas. It's difficult to get around country because the road system is very poor. There are a few roads that are easy to drive on that can go to some of the main cities, but once you're past the main cities, you're going to be on a two-lane dirt road for primarily throughout the whole country. And the country itself is only the size of Tennessee, if you were to envision that. So it's not a large country, but to get from one end to the other might take you 2 days, 2 days drive just based on the poor condition of the roads. The population of Liberia is primarily made up in the more out areas outside of the city of Monrovia, which is the capital. You have a lot of tribes there. I think there's 16 different tribes in Liberia. And you'll often find those would be the primary organizations that operate in these rainforest areas and some of the more rural areas. Downtown Monrovia is similar to a downtown city. It has has a lot of main streets, a lot of built-up infrastructure, and a lot of businesses that are operating within the city of Monrovia.
Well, Colonel, I think you also want to bring it back to who you're particularly advising. We talked about this a little bit earlier before the broadcast, which is I think you're maybe you can tell us a little bit about the Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces of Liberia.
Sure, yeah. And I spend a lot of time with the Chief of Staff, Brigadier General Daniel Zancan, who was appointed the Chief of Staff of the Liberian Army in February of 2014. He is a very bright gentleman. He's been educated in the United States. He's gone through similar courses that I have as far as Command and General Staff College, and has recently undertaken some executive education at Harvard University. He's very smart, and he's also he realizes, the unique position he's in as the first leader of, the Armed Forces of Liberia since the Civil War. He's very cognizant of that. He has a strong message to the soldiers of Liberia to consistently, he is reinforcing, the subordination of the military to civil authority. And that is the message, that's critical to ensure that the country doesn't undergo any challenging military coups or security force coups, as often happens in West Africa. Again, a great individual, a good friend, and definitely somebody who is the right person to be leading the Armed Forces of Liberia at this point in its development.
That's great to hear, and it's great to hear that we're building strong ties with other professional soldiers such as that. Colonel, where are you in your tour? You're about halfway through, or what's your status?
Yeah, so our tour started in December of 2014 and will end in October of this year. So we are coming close to our halfway point, in the tour, and our whole team is, you're looking forward to continuing to, support some of the initiatives that are going on with the Armed Forces of Liberia. We have a 30-person augmentation team that has been provided from U.S. Army Africa headquarters, and they are actually assisting us with some supportive training for some of the Liberians, the Liberian Army, in some basic tactics and some basic training that, as a 15-person mentor force, we just don't have adequate trainers in order to accomplish all of this. So that force will be here for another 20 days, and then they'll head back there from Fort Bliss, Texas. And then we'll get more into steady state mentorship operations, working on plans, logistics, training, and some future growth issues.
And that was a live interview with Colonel Stephen Potter. Tune in next week on Veterans Radio. Bob Gould will be on with his guest, Dr. Rebecca Grant. Until then, you are dismissed.